Welcome to Speak with Eve. I am your host, Eve Eurydice. And today I have with me Anna Minton. Anna is a journalist, writer, and academic. She has written two acclaimed books, Ground Control and Big Capital. She is now working on a book about the global housing crisis and extreme gentrification happening in, you know, urban centers. Welcome to the show, Anna.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. You and I have had, you know, a couple of really interesting conversations there, and I am very interested in this research that you're doing, because I think that it's a problem that affects women in particular, considering that for thousands and thousands of years, we didn't get housing of our own, and we were not expected to think about those things, right? So we're latecomers, and just as we joined this, like, you know, housing search, oops, there is extreme gentrification, you know, everything is super expensive, everybody's like squeezed in smaller and smaller spaces. I would love to hear about the research that you're doing now and what you're finding.
Yeah, sure. So well, I'm in Miami now at the moment.
Yes.
I'm on a two-week research trip around the US. I'm actually leaving for Atlanta this afternoon. And the reason I'm in America is because, well, the book is about the global housing crisis, but I'm particularly on English speaking economies. And I'm really interested in the impact of American policies on cities, American policies on housing, gentrification, how we look at cities, because these have actually affected us in the UK. We talk a lot about the UK being the 51st state. And, you know, it really is. We literally come over to the US and we copy your policies and we take them home and we implement them. Benny, I'm in Miami and I've just been so struck by the extreme level of change compared to the last time I was here in 2018. I'm coming from London, which is a city where, you know, everywhere you look, there's construction, luxury apartment towers going up. You know, we're really in the sort of throes of this maelstrom. And I've come here and it seems the same. Construction absolutely everywhere. People I've talked to have said these apartments are just not affordable for people who live in Miami at all. Airbnb investors, second and third homes. And then, you know, I've been to neighborhoods like Little Haiti, which seems to be very much the next place for this pattern of gentrification. And the whole city is just being swallowed up by this unaffordability crisis. And next I'm moving on to Atlanta, where the role of private equities is playing a huge role. I mean, it is in Miami.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah, everywhere, you know.
We talked together about how as artists are often very much associated with changes in cheaper neighborhoods. But talk about women too. So we've got a lot
There's a lot. Yeah, it's a huge topic, and I think that it's a burning issue, because, you know, like food and shelter, right? Like access to water, food and shelter. It's the most fundamental stuff, and we are becoming so. We, meaning people at large, but for the billionaires, seem to be becoming increasingly at a faster and faster pace dependent on others rather than self-sufficient. In my grandmother's generation, everybody had access to land and everybody had space, and, you know, you didn't even pay. Property taxes were introduced in Greece recently after the, you know, crisis that almost resulted in Grexit, like Brexit. But my point is, we didn't have property taxes. There was no such concept, you know, land. Everybody owned more land that they could think of using, and it wasn't worth anything. Again, through the EU, which has spread American policies to the rest of Europe, we have been offering these golden visas, more and more apartments in Athens, in the cities in on my island of Lesbos, the cities on the island of Crete where my mom lives. The apartments are being bought by investors. Thousands of people from China. It doesn't matter where they are from. It matters what they're worth, right? So we're back to basic Marxist thinking, because the rest is just, you know, like decoration, but it's really the super rich against the masses. Well, I think,
yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this, the financialization of housing, you know, you're seeing it everywhere, as you say, you know, seeing it in London, in Miami, in Greece, on Lesbos, you know,
all over. All around and me on this little, on this little shore where there was never any foreigner. It had not occurred to anyone. And right now, span of less than a decade, there are entire old villages taken over by people from Europe, you know, like the Germans have taken one village, the Dutch have taken one village, that sort of thing. My mom's apartment, a new building, every apartment except for hers and one more is owned by Europeans or foreigners who use it to come in the summer and vacation.
Well, I mean, you know, what you're seeing there is the tourism economy aspect of this, which is a really significant aspect of this, if you think about Airbnb, second homes, etc. But the sort of the underlying themes, that there are two underlying big themes, I think, which is that today's economy is based very much on property. So that's the sort of the main theme. And then sort of alongside that, that means that housing, well, all aspects of land and property, but housing, you know, being an intrinsic part of that, is primarily an investment rather than a place to live. So, you know, its key raison d'etre is its exchange value rather than its use value. So it's an invest vehicle. Mm-hmm. And this really accelerated, to my mind, since the financial crisis.
2008.
I mean, before the financial crisis, you know, these trends were in play. They've been in play for the last, you know, they're part of that sort of Reagan, Thatcher, Reaganomic approach. But the financial crisis really kicked it off for a number of reasons. And actually, one of the areas I'm going to look at in my book is monetary policy as well, because it's some of the financial policies that are in place which have really spurred this on. And actually, you know, governments have enabled people with a lot of wealth to accumulate ever greater wealth.
That's right.
But, you know, in property, because we're living in a property economy.
Yes. Yes, that's right. And 2008, remember, it was based on bad mortgages. That's how the cost happened. And the government did not punish anybody. None of the people in charge, you know, none of the banks, everybody was too big to fail. All the managers, everybody became even more rich. The people who got punished were the people, the poor people or the poorer people who had bought properties as investments or to flip, thinking they had caught on.
Yeah. And I mean, not only that, you know, the solution was actually, especially here in the US, was seen to be facilitating these private equity companies to come in and buy up a lot of these foreclosed homes.
Yes.
The
yes.
phrase I use in the book, from subprime to super prime.
That's beautiful. You know, yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah, yeah. they printed all that money, which then they lent to the very rich, which they could take and buy up cheaply the properties of people who were going under.
That's a simple way of looking at it. And I think one of the issues is because of these financialized processes and policies with names like quantitative easing, you know, they're so complicated. That was the creation of trillions of dollars and pounds and euros. Mm-hmm. So one of the really big issues is the sheer complexity of policies. I mean, you've explained it just now in a really simple way, but actually when you have, you know, monetary policies with terminology like quantitative easing, most people don't know what that is. They feel sort of excluded from participating in a discussion about thing. takes you back to the subprime crisis, when the sheer range of these complicated financialized vehicles and tools, people just couldn't understand what's going on. In some ways, it's very similar now. You know, these processes actually, you know, people don't think they can understand what's going on. And so,
well, I think
somehow
that the complexity is on purpose. You know, it's baked in to alienate the vast population, and it's almost like a private club. It's the same way that, like, famous private clubs, you know, of the wealthy in London. It's the way that, you know, the white men and whoever they let in, but mostly the rich white men, have kept control, and then they can let the rest of the spoils, which are very small in comparison, right, be fought over among the big population.
Yes, I mean, I think the only area that I perhaps disagree with you on is I don't think it's sort of directly on purpose. I think there's a group of people sitting in the room and saying, let's make this all seem so complicated that nobody can understand it. But I think it becomes self-reinforcing. I mean, every area and discipline has its own language and its own jargon, and it sort of protects itself. And, you know, the art world has it. The architecture world has it. You know, every area you'll go into has it. It's not exactly on purpose, but it becomes this sort of self-reinforcing enclave, if you like. And, you know, finance and policy making are sort of particularly like that. I'm not sure if I made it much sense.
Well, okay, as a personal example, I arrived in America, I was 15. At 16, I was at NYU as a freshman. And I was so proud of myself because I, you know, received permission to join a senior seminar on world peace. Now, I was a Marxist, a little Marxist, you know, coming to America from Greece. So I understood world peace the way a socialist understands it. And I did believe that it was Marx who had come up first with this idea that we can overcome our borders, right? Be nationalists, because after all, workers of the world unite. Well, what I learned is that the opposite, you know, that the powers that be had taken over this concept, turned it around to use it to their benefit. And I was so shocked, Anna. I took all incompletes. I had like a breakdown. I wrote my final thesis. The professor who had been an ambassador for Reagan to China, I mean, and now he was teaching at NYU, rejected it, called me to his office, and he said, this looks like you have, you know, like Marxist ideologist, and, you know, you have to rewrite your paper. Yeah, what he was teaching us was that multinational corporations, as they called them then, would guarantee world peace.
Yeah.
And I was like, say what? Yeah. And that was the first I heard. And he was grooming the students to work for, you know, he would get them interviews because they were seniors to work for those multinational corporations. That was 1980 or 81.
Growth was, you know, a representative, a key representative of, you know, and neoliberal ideology. And when you look at how that neoliberal ideology began, actually really sort of took hold, you know, it really started to take hold in Chicago among the economists of the Chicago School under Milton Friedman. And, you know, Reagan and Thatcher really took those ideas forward. You know, that is, I'm sure, exactly the situation. You had professors like yours who were, you know, living it and teaching it, and couldn't, you know, didn't want to debate the points that you were putting across in your paper. And these have been very much the beliefs that, you know, markets are natural, markets are sacred, markets will do the best for the economy.
Will self-regulate, which is such bullshit, because, you know, the truth is that money is immoral. I mean, money is amoral. And since it doesn't have a morality, in practical terms, it's immoral. Morality, it has to be imposed on you. Otherwise, you will, by default, immoral. And there is no regulation because there is this myth that the market will take care of itself.
It's part of the myth. You know, especially in the US, where there's this idea of really small government, the biggest part of the myth is that government isn't involved. Government is really involved. You know, government is stepping in and they're subsidizing the private sector everywhere they can, and they're creating conditions which are as favorable as possible. And, you know, policies such as quantitative easing, you know, were created to bail out the financial system. That was a huge, you know, that was a global financial failure of neoliberalism. But, you know, what has happened afterwards is that the whole sort of market ideology has just rebounded back to such a degree. And yet, you know, because of government intervention and because government has said to, you know, all of these companies, come in and sort out the situation, sort out the housing crisis, private equity companies like Blackstone, by you know, buying up all these foreclosed homes. And then, you know, they have these huge portfolios and they rent them out at really high prices and really poor conditions. But it's government policy which enabled that.
Yeah.
So that's the part of the myth that I find really difficult.
The 1913, I think it was like Christmas 1913, that's the lore, when Woodrow Wilson set up the Fed. From that time onward, America has been held hostage, right? You know, he's hated for many other things. and of course, the Marshall Plan, which is like how America learned to, you know, buy obedience, right? Or buy love. And it's never stopped using that formula. And then the next step was 1971, when I think Nixon dropped the gold standard and enforced the petrodollar in exchange. Like, again, theoretically, it was like to curb inflation, but really it was, you know, they, and to save the dollar, right, from foreign nations that had gold. But really it was to force everybody to use the dollar to trade oil, right? And then all the wars that we have had recently, Iraq, you know, Syria, even, you know, Libya for sure, and even what happening in Ukraine, again, they are because of oil, control of the currency that is used for the trade of energy. So if BRICS is successful, it will lead to some sort of conflagration. Either the West will let go completely of, you know, going to like other alternative energies, or will fight a war to get that monopoly back. I'm digressing a bit, but I think it's all part of the bigger picture of a sort of control. We work and toil under the delusion that we are participants, you know, in a system that excludes us.
Yeah, I just don't believe in conspiracy theories. You know, I think kind of, you know, we make our own situation as collective. I do think that, you know, the whole system doesn't work, and the global financial crash was just the clearest example we've had yet of the extent to which the system doesn't work. And, you know, most people don't understand how the economy works and how money works. You know, they think that it works a little bit like the household budget. If you save money, you know, things will get better. You know, it doesn't work in any way like this. And but I don't think there's a conspiracy sort of at play.
But I do believe that the history of the world since World War II pretty much, you know, has favored capital and the rich, you know.
You know, I think the way I see it, I mean, I guess I do see that the post-war consensus, you know, broadly speaking, you know, for 30 years between the end of the war until the late 1970s, the post-war consensus was providing a more equitable world. And part of the reason for that was the Cold War, because, you know, governments in the US, in the UK, in Europe, they would look at what was happening over the Iron Curtain and they would say, okay, yes, there's censorship and, you know, there's all sorts of really problematic things that our populations are aware of. But there's also a really high standard of healthcare, a really high standard of education, and everyone is really well housed. So they had to do similar things, especially in Europe, for their population.
Interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. The
Cold War, you know, at around the time that you went to NYU and encountered your ambassador professor, you know, the neoliberals, basically, they thought that they had won. You know, this was their high moment. This was the end of history. Extreme capitalism on the neoliberal model just, you know, had no, you know, it's unfettered after this point. And, you know, in many ways, the or had held it back. So I think that's the sort of trajectory that I see.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, and I agree with that. I that makes sense to me. That date, you know, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and that's it. Then, you know, all the curbs are off and go run after the money. This extreme consolidation has and been then, taking you place, know, you know, of wealth.
And then just to bring it back to our main focus, mm-hmm. you know, at the same time, you see the shift in the economic base from an industrial economy to a post-industrial economy. Mm-hmm. And post-industrial economy of financial services, tech, retail, entertainment becomes one which is increasingly a property-based economy. Mm-hmm. And so today, you know, most people make far more money out of owning their own home, if they are lucky enough to have one, than they do from wages, you know, because wages have stagnated, economic growth has stagnated, but you have this continual property price inflation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, because of the consolidation, because it's not just in housing, which is your area, but also like farmland, you know, with big agro, just, you know, eating up people's farms. This is an extreme, yeah. you know, extreme problem in America, and I believe increasingly yeah. in Europe. But just to backtrack, and then we'll come back to the current moment. Speaking of the Cold War, I feel that post-World War II, that era, from then until the end of the Cold War, that was the time of the huge change in economic migration, extreme urbanization, and of course the liberation of women to enter the workforce in huge numbers. Right. So those were three changes that have never happened before. As a result of that war, I mean, my own country, like, you know, the villages and the islands were emptied and everyone went abroad to work or went to Athens. And then the money from the Marshall Plan built up Athens and transformed it into a concrete city of little apartments, right? Instead of everybody living in a box. And I believe that that happened in many places simultaneously around the world. And that was a shock to the system of many people. You know, traveling, you know, on boats across the world to look for work in places where you knew no one, right? And be dependent on whoever paid you. That's a huge change in human consciousness, depending on boss, not your family or your neighbors, you know. And then women did not have generational wealth. You know, women were excluded from owning property and excluded from inheritances unless it went to their husbands. All of a sudden, that's another disenfranchised, you know, huge population that becomes, you know, individualized and set out to find work and compete with all these men who are also all over the place looking for work. The conditions for human life changed, and we all were kind of cut loose from our familiar support systems and sent out there. And then at the same time, you have this like growing consolidation of capital. And then the Berlin Wall falls, and the end of history basically is the beginning of full-on unfettered capitalism or late capitalism.
That's, yeah, that's right. And really, you know, the concern of my books mm-hmm. has been to see how that extreme capitalism is reflected in our cities, you know, in the buildings, in the public spaces, in the places we live.
Yeah.
The city environment is a reflection of social, economic, cultural and political conditions. So that's what I try to that's the lens, essentially.
Yeah. Well, Miami Beach here, you know, if you walk at night, I'm going to say that 90% of the apartments are empty because they're second homes, third homes, investment homes. And they don't, you know, the owners don't need to make money by renting them. They can write them off, do some improvements and take them off their taxes. Or, you know, they're being bought for money laundering purposes.
And who are they bought by?
Foreigners. Corporations, I would say 95% of purchases are through LLCs. But even individuals now will buy with an LLC.
Like, that's to avoid tax, right?
To avoid Eastern identification.
So, yes. So, I mean, mm-hmm. so your neighbors, like, I mean, do you not have many neighbors?
Well, I don't live in in one of those condo buildings where this is what's happening. In my case, I would say 50% is either owner occupied or renter occupied, but there is 50% right. owned by either, you know, developers or corporations. The property values of the building, for example, because if you decide yeah. to lower the price, then we're all getting affected. The individual like is trying to hold on and has, you know, their entire equity in a little place, mm-hmm. and then you're competing with this like monster owner or developers. The other big shock to the system in Miami Beach in particular is that since the fall of the building in Surfside, there have been new rules about certification, insurance, and partial reserves required. So thousands and thousands of people from the lower income and middle income classes are losing their apartments because they can't afford the higher assessments. You know, a lot of them are seniors on fixed income. They can't pay these huge assessments. They can't pay the, you know, the extra money required for insurance, and they're selling.
Yeah.
The gentrification that we were talking about, you know, when I first came to Miami, was juried into a studio in the Arts Florida on Lincoln Road. At the time, I bought a condo on the beach for under $100,000. Sold it a few years later for like three times that money, and I thought I was so smart. And of course, you shouldn't, you know, because now I can't buy it. Now it's like 10 times that money. You know, I bought a place I bought a house that if I had held on to, I would be now a multimillionaire. But of course, at the time, I was like, oh my God, this appreciated so much. I can make, as you said, much more money than I would ever make working. So I'm selling my place. But each time that I sold it, I had to buy something less expensive. And the people you sell it to are always kind of like the ultra rich, you know, like you don't sell it to people of your own socioeconomic group. You sell it to people because it has appreciated, who are much wealthier. And then as it appreciates even more, they sell it to people who are much wealthier than them. So I sold mine to a celebrity who sold it to a billionaire. But regarding like art studio, I had that studio for like 6 or 7 years. I lived off that studio because it was on Lincoln Road. So it was an amazing opportunity because, you know, most artists have to adjust what they make to the gallery feeder system. You make what you know sells. Conscious or unconscious bias, you need your gallery to want your art, and the gallery tells you make more like this. This sells. Don't make this like tortured stuff. Make more of these flowers. Look, the whole show sold, right? And you do.
Yeah.
Because... Yeah. You have to live.
Yeah.
So it was amazing to actually get off the gallery, an exclusive representation anymore. I only showed wherever galleries, you know, around wherever the US, etc., wanted to show me, but no exclusive gallery. And I sold out of the studio, and I sold almost every day, and I lived off of that for like almost 6 years. And also, you know, hundreds and hundreds of people, students, you know, Miami is not a very feminist city, so like having someone with a public space who is a known feminist, you know, all the young students, girls who studied architecture would just hang out and talk.
And when was that? What period?
So that was until the building got sold. So I got juried in the year after Art Basel came to Miami, led to kind of the artistic, let's call it renaissance, right, of the city. And it ended 2014. So let's say, you know, about 7 years before that. 2014, the board, but after our representative, the artist representative on the board was kicked out, and the board sold the building for $88 million. Now, this building was a co-op bought by artists. As a co-op to fellow artists, for a place for artists to have studio that's subsidized. The building was 800 and 810 Lincoln Road, so it was a prime location, of course, you know.
Right.
But like for that decade that I was there, people from all over Miami Beach, this was their weekend ritual. They would come to Lincoln Road, they would have something to eat, they would look at antiques, they would come in and look at the art, maybe they would go to the movies. That's what people did with their families. This whole thing was lost. All the artists who were in that art center have pretty much been left studioless because there is no subsidized rent anywhere, so there is nowhere for people to go. You know, you can't afford the studio rents.
Can I bring you back? You mentioned Art Basel.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, how much of an impact do you think Art Basel has had on all these processes of raising property values and actually making life a lot more difficult for artists?
The beginning, it had a positive effect. So I would say the first 5 years, there was a positive effect in the sense that people, residents of Miami, became much more art aware and became increasingly art buyers. So you had more middle class, upper middle class collectors, you know, mini collectors who wouldn't have been otherwise. People went to Art Basel. It was an event that the population at large, you know, could attend. In the long run, it had a negative effect because it made the gentrification much worse. So where Art Basel is now, in the convention center, there are no art studios anywhere. There are no art studios in Miami Beach, period. So Art Basel was maybe, you know, 1,000 feet from that art center where I was. The convention center has been rebuilt where Art Basel is housed. Education seems to always be favorable to artists in the beginning because we're used as decoration, as like shop window. Like when Greg Robbins was completely rebuilding the design district, which used to be like antique shops. I mean, I bought my furniture there. You know, when I came here from New York, to me, it looked like a glorified flea market. But I bought it all. His father owned and developed Lincoln Road, as far as I remember. His brother developed Sunset Harbor, which again was like, you know, inexpensive apartments and now have become completely unaffordable. And when Greg moved to the design district, I was lucky enough, I felt lucky enough, you know, to be invited to take on different spaces for free. And my only job was to open up, have it look like a gallery and have a reception with wine and crackers every Saturday, the first Saturday of every month, which he said the first Saturday of every month was like art night, and people from all over town could come and there would be open galleries. So we would get these, you know, prime storefronts, which eventually became all the different stores, the Prada and the, right, the Yves Saint Laurent, or they became restaurants. But while he was developing it, we just had them and we would put art, you know, we would paint them, make them look nice, put art on the walls, open once a month. We were all grateful. The place looked nice, right? Light, art, color, people were drawn to it. And then once, of course, you know, he rented them, that ended that. He took over an elementary school in that area, a couple of blocks down. And while the permits went through to demolish it and build a mall on top of it, I had access to it. So I was able to, he gave it to me, and I was able to stitch my 30-foot long tapestries there, and actually in the auditorium, because I had space that I never had before, such a wonderful like floor space. Then when Tony Goldman was developing Wynwood, I was given, again, word of mouth, he heard that I had the space in the design district, so he gave me a similar deal there.
Well, and he just approached you and said, you know...
No, not he
like
himself.
To... Sure.
But again, I had no free studio with these openings, same thing, until they were renting them out, and they said, okay, now if you want to stay, you can rent it. And of course, I couldn't afford it, so I left. My point is that right now, so we're now in 2024, there are no free spaces at all. And for artists to find something clear affordable, you have to go to like Alapata. You have to go like 2 hours west, an hour or two west. You know, when I mean, I used to volunteer teach at the women's shelter, the Lotus House, the shelter for homeless women there. And it was an area that people were afraid to go to. Well, that's now where we are, everybody is looking for studios, which tells you that that's the next place to be gentrified. I did have a studio in Little Haiti and Little River. And then that got sold. It was run by Fountainhead. It's a situation that seems to be good for artists, but in the end, it's crushing because the end is inevitable and it's never going to be to our advantage. I think that same consolidation is happening in every field. You know, art is just an example, but I think that whether it's like the little stores, they have all disappeared. You know, Lincoln Road was like little mom and pop stores. Now you only have chains because they are the only ones who can afford the rents.
I think artists are particularly interesting though, because they are actively, well, exploited, I would say. Developers, you know, developers seek them out and they offer them free space, you know, in great places, which are perfectly suited to their practice. and the artists help make the area attractive. And then, you know, when the area is ready for development, the art kicked out. Yeah. Yes, I mean, it's the same, you know, in many arenas, but, you know, and of course, independent shops are part of that. But, it, you know, artists are deliberately brought on board, as you said earlier, you know, decoration. Yeah. But it's kind of, it's more than decoration. It's kind of an essential part of the developer's strategy. And what really surprised me when I came to Miami in 2018 was just how naked. I mean, in the day, you know, artists are also very much associated with gentrification, cheap areas, warehouse spaces, you know, then the areas become hip and then the developers move in. But here, you know, I was just surprised that, you know, Tony Goldman's strategy at Wynwood, you know, was just actually, you know, it was this outdoor gallery area, graffiti area. And actually the artists are paid to do that. Well, you know, for me, that's not graffiti. You know, the definition of graffiti is that it's illegal. And now I discover that actually what is illegal is to do any graffiti in Wynwood, which isn't allowed.
Correct. I know. So, isn't that ironic? Yeah.
So that's why, you know, I came to Miami to look at this story in particular, because it just seems to be one of the most, you know, extreme examples. But it's a process which is, you know, as you say, happening everywhere.
Oh, I forgot to mention on a smaller scale, after COVID ended, because the lockdown shut down a lot of the storefronts on Lincoln Road. So before anybody really reopened, when there were still most of the storefronts, the windows were empty. Right, we got an opportunity, a group of us artists, to get a subsidized studio space. It wasn't on the street level, it was on the third floor in these offices that I think had been used by a travel agency or some other company had been there, but they had shut down, so the developer wasn't getting any rent. So he said, okay, artists, I'll give this to you subsidized, not at market value, and you can have your events. Downstairs was another real estate office, you know, as a storefront, and he said, you can use that empty space as your gallery and have an opening every month. So once again, each one of us would get a show downstairs, and then we would get our friends, our collectors, email list, people would come in the building. Once a month, we would have open studios. Did that for about a year, and then he said, okay, you know, that the party's over. I got renters now who will pay market value. Out you go.
Yeah.
So that's that. If you think about it, from the point of view of the public, it looks sophisticated. There is like, oh, art and beauty and interesting kind of like intellectual conversations. But in reality, it's despair. We're all, we artists are so desperate that we'll say yes to these so-called opportunities that we know are not really opportunity. We have to pay to install our work. We have to pay to move. We have to pay to get out. We have to pay to fix all the places, make them pretty, right? All this stuff that we do. We know it's ephemeral.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. So the post-COVID space, that was the last studio experience you've had in the city.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I can't commute that far just to go to a studio. Reconsider my art career.
Yeah, it's a really depressing situation. And it's very, very similar in London. And, you know, lots and lots of artists leave London. You know, they go and live in cheaper towns. So it's become quite a famous trajectory that artists move out of London and they go to some of the seaside towns like Hastings or Margate. You know, these are the places that artists live in now, having gentrified famous areas of London like Hoxton and Shoreditch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same thing here. A lot of the artists have left. You know, some have gone to like Delray Beach, Donna, wherever. You know, people have spread out. You know, Tony Goldman learned how to do that in Soho, because he famously developed Soho the same way. And there was, his name is Moise Mana, and he did the same thing in first in New Jersey, where he bought like huge warehouses, put artists in, developed the areas, and then sold them for much more. And then he came here and he bought huge areas out by the air where no one had ever shown art. And he set up like recording studios, artist studios, different types of like studios, very affordable rent where people went. But anyway, so it's something that keeps happening. I think there will always be like young artists who can take, you know, who can take the abuse, you know, who will go wherever this opportunity.
Well, I think that's, that's right. And the sort of the depressing thing as conditions worsen, not just for artists, but housing conditions, you know, people do move, but also they stay put, but they put up with the kind of conditions that you would never expect to have to be able to. And I mean, perhaps that brings it back to the conversation about how women are affected, because, you know, often, you know, it's women with children who have to put up with the worst conditions of the housing crisis. Some of the stories I featured in my previous book where, you know, it's women with children who are moved out of London and then moved out by actually the local authority to other parts of the country. I mean, I know that in the US, housing policy is actually much more difficult. You know, the level of homeless population is huge and assistance is really, really hard to come by. But it's women and children who are, you know, completely on the front line of that experience, inevitably.
Oh, yeah, because, you know, a woman will do anything for her children. She will be exploited in, you know, if the landlord needs sex on the side to let her stay, he will get that. It doesn't matter because she's doing it for her children. It's not, you know, she's not alone.
I mean, another area that I was taken to yesterday, Little Haiti, trailer park there, which was just cleared away. And Magic City has not been developed, but there were thousands of people living there, lots and lots of families. And so what happened to those people? You know, the person who was showing me, you know, he said, where did they go? You know, nobody knows where these people go.
Yeah, probably closer to the swamp. That's what's happening, you know, away from, you know, development and closer to the swamp. I'm going to close with this thought. I would love for us all to take advantage of the internet and move back to the country. But, you know, we can't move back to the country the way we left it. We have to do it in a more organized way because the country doesn't have healthcare. The country doesn't have stores. You know, speaking of like women alone with children, the country doesn't have security. But rather than continuing this urbanization, you know, going back to nature, I think, is the only solution and salvation for the greater population. The urbanization it leads us toward some sort of suicide. We need to reconnect with our roots and Mother Nature. And, you know, we have done that for millennia. And this experiment has been maybe not yet a century. I think that people will have better mental health. We are hooked to so many habits now that we consider essential for our life, like entertainment.
I mean, can I add a sort of a closing thought to that? So, you know, I'm a city person. I was born in a city. I've grown up in a city, and I've always lived in the city. And I love the countryside, but, you know, personally, I probably want to stay in a smallish city. I find London a bit big, but, you know, I think, you know, city life has, you know, an enormous amount to offer. I don't think it's the city or the country. I think it's much more a question of the organization of the economy. And I also think, you know, it's the policy directions that we follow that are critically important. And I suppose, you know, my big fear is that people feel that, you know, these are processes that they can't do anything about, you know, that they're disconnected from, or, you know, there are bigger forces at work, you know. And actually, if you look behind it, it's actually quite straightforward. You know, they are quite simple. simple policy decisions. And just by being aware of what's going on, we can do something to influence the sort of city that we live in and to make it a city that can be for all of us. So, you know, I think I do still very much believe in the city, but I think we just have to be talking about how we can constantly do, you know, little things to try and make the city one, you know, that we can still all have a place in. I don't know if that sort of sounds...
I hope that you're right. It sounded a little Pollyanna-ish, but I'm with you. I hope you're right, my dear.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's just a question of different policies. And to be blunt, I think that the approach of the last 40 years, you know, the neoliberal Reaganomics approach has wreaked absolutely huge amounts of damage on the city, and that is accelerating even. And it's an approach which is also wreaking huge damage on the UK. And in Europe, there is actually a much more interventionist approach. And while things are not perfect in Europe, I would say the huge inequalities and the huge extremes of the housing crisis are not as bad there. And that's as a result of policy. So we should be looking to more interventionist policies. And we should be looking, you know, we've talked a little bit about language. The word I would really like to reconsider is regulation. Regulation seems to be a dirty word, particularly in America, where anything associated with intervention is a bad thing. But we who are progressive and who want to see, you know, a city for everybody, we need to talk, even talking, you know, even changing discourse, we need to try to rebrand the idea of regulation and intervention so that we can put in place policies to create a city for all.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think economic policy has to be completely revisited. I'm not optimistic because we have the most progressive government we have had these past 3 years, and they have been the same as the Republicans for, you know, the same as everybody else.
I know that
I think that as long as, like, you have corporations have the same rights as people and they can buy elections, and, you know, you have lobbyists and donors and that, you know, huge donor mm-hmm. class, things can appear to be better, but they're not, you know. At most you get crumbs, you know, yeah. Whether you get like some student loans forgiven or whatever, you get the same crumbs as like we artists get for a couple of years when we get, you know, free rent or subsidized rent, but you don't actually get any fundamental change.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one of the difficulties with these conversations is that you have these conversations and you end up by feeling so bleak. One of the issues with having this sort of conversation is that you start to feel quite despairing by the end of it, given the situation that we're all finding ourselves in. And I always turn to this quote, which I just love, by the art critic John Berger.
Oh, yeah.
And he said,
ways of seeing.
Hope is not a form of guarantee. It's a form of energy. And very frequently, that energy is strongest in circumstances that are very dark. I think that's a wonderful quote because, you know, while I'm also very pessimistic, I think we can be hopeful and we can be optimistic, you know, not least because we're having interesting conversations where we see possibilities.
Yes, yes. Okay, this is a beautiful place to close. Thank you, Anna.
Thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure. And everybody out there, thank you for listening. And until next week, keep speaking life, housing, shelter, and truth and freedom.
Still my